Hello, welcome to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond. Now, 3 weeks ago, we started our show with news of a mystery virus that had emerged in China. Back then, many people hadn't heard of it. How things have moved on. As we record this on Wednesday, Wuhan City in China has been shut down and quarantined. Some airlines are cancelling flights. Confirmed cases of the new coronavirus have emerged outside China. And some people from overseas are being repatriated to their home countries, in some cases after a period of quarantine. In a moment, we'll ask what else we need to know medically to really know which measures will be effective in controlling the outbreak. Also, later in the show, the typhoid exhibition touring the world. And have you ever had the sense that you shouldn't really be allowed to do what you do and that you only get to carry on because no one's found you out yet? The psychology of imposter syndrome and how to overcome it. But back to the coronavirus. I've been speaking to Wendy Barclay, Professor of Virology at Imperial College London, to find out what big medical questions still remain around the virus. Questions which, of course, make a big difference to whether closing down cities or stopping flights will work. Currently, on Wednesday, there are 5,900 confirmed cases in China and 56 among 14 other countries. And there are another 9,000 suspected cases as well. I started by asking Wendy how hard it is to keep track of the latest numbers of cases and of fatalities.
I think it's very likely that there's a huge backlog at the moment. The laboratories in China, for sure, are processing thousands and thousands of samples at the moment to identify who's carrying the virus. And what we must remember is that this is also the time of year when we normally have other colds and flu. So a lot of people will be having a swab taken to be processed and then not be positive for this virus. Keeping track of all of this is a gigantuan task. And I think inevitably there is a bit of a backlog, and sometimes the numbers of deaths or the number of cases are not necessarily in sync with each other.
And what's our current understanding on when people can catch the virus from someone else now that it seems that person-to-person transmission is happening? How do they catch it?
I think the most likely scenario is that this is an airborne virus. There are other coronaviruses that circulate amongst us and cause around about 15% of the common colds that we as humans have every year. And those viruses, those human coronaviruses that cause relatively mild common colds, pass from one person to the other through respiratory secretions and droplets that are probably carried in the air as we breathe. What is not clear completely at the moment is whether or not the transmission of this new virus can happen from people in the early phases of infection before they show symptoms. The obvious comparator virus here is SARS. The reason that we were able to control SARS was because it really only did spread from person to person when the person was obviously sick.
And I guess it's hard when we don't seem to know exactly how quickly people develop symptoms. I was looking and the WHO is suggesting between 2 and 10 days. And then there's a particular paper in The Lancet looking at one family. And there they're suggesting maybe 3 to 6 days.
I think you've got the numbers of days and the variation spot on. And I think that's what we can expect. When a person catches a virus, the course of the virus in an individual is dependent on many things. We're all different from each other. Did we get a big dose from somebody who coughed in our face, or did we get a smaller dose from somebody who was standing at the other end of the bus? And all of those things affect the dynamics of the way the virus works inside our body, how quickly it replicates, how sick it makes us, and how soon we show symptoms, and how soon we might pass our own virus on to someone else. The sequence information that we have so far does indicate that this one virus was a single point introduction. So it wasn't that there was a source in the markets that was crossing into lots of different people from lots of different animals. It looks like there was a single source that crossed into some people and then sparked this outbreak. That being said, we need to understand in the long term where this virus has come from in order to work out how to stop it from happening again.
Is it possible at the moment to tell how dangerous this virus is compared with, say, SARS?
The case fatality rates are varying widely. We're looking at something less than 2% at the moment. So fewer than 2 in every 100 people who are getting infected are dying. And I think the likelihood is that that number is going to go down because there are probably many, many people out there who have been infected by this virus but haven't really been sick enough to even be counted yet in the numbers. This is what we sort of call a pyramid. And there'll be some people at the very tip of the pyramid that we can see because they're very sick and they're easy for us to count. But at the fat base of the pyramid, there are many, many people who may have been infected and haven't really been sick enough for us to count. And all of those people will eventually add into the numbers to calculate whether this is a more dangerous virus than SARS.
For those who are in hospital at the moment, is there any sort of treatment for them?
With coronaviruses, unfortunately, at the moment, we don't have any antiviral drugs which have been developed specifically to work against this class of viruses. What they will be receiving in hospital is care to help them do their very best to fight their virus off, maintain their fluid levels properly, and give them the best chance.
And to try to stop it spreading, does this mass quarantining that we're seeing work? Some are arguing that if you leave everyone all together, then it might just spread faster within those than if you let people move around in the normal way. Do we know the answer to that?
There are many different approaches at the moment being tried about restricting movement of people, from shutting down whole cities to asking people to self-isolate at home. I mean, what is clear is that viruses have to move from person to person in order to perpetuate themselves. Our ability to control this virus really will come down, I think, to whether or not it's transmitting effectively between people who aren't showing symptoms. And it really is a balance at the moment between what is the social cost and the economic cost of these isolation routes versus how serious in the long run this virus is going to be.
And as we speak on Wednesday, the World Health Organization hasn't yet classified this as a public health emergency of international concern. Do you think it should be?
I think as the numbers mount, the World Health Organization will possibly be rethinking that.
Wendy Barclay. And my guest today is BBC Health and Science correspondent James Gallagher. I'm guessing you've been covering this coronavirus a lot in the last few days, James.
In a week, I've managed to do two stories that are not related to the coronavirus, and everything else has been all about this.
So we talked there a bit about what hospitals can do for people. Is there anything other than keeping people hydrated that they can offer?
Well, you have to remember that the people who are most severely ill tend to have other diseases, so it's managing those as well. A lot of respiratory illness, so you're looking at breathing support. And there are trials of drugs, antiviral drugs, that have proven successful in, say, SARS and MERS are being used in this outbreak too, to see if those are effective as well. But that's very much at the kind of like give it and hope kind of stage of medicine.
Because those weren't developed for this virus
exactly.
In particular.
And they've not, because this is so new, nothing has been tested against it. So we're kind of doing trials on patients on deathbeds, basically.
And in China, they've been building a brand new hospital, especially to house people.
Two.
Have you seen the videos of them? It's amazing. The
foundations
are all there,
and it's just sort of growing. Of like dozens and dozens and dozens of diggers and cranes all working. It's amazing.
Yeah, and there's talk of them being finished within a week, which is just amazing. But if this does spread to more countries, presumably most places, I mean, they won't be able to respond in the same way.
I think you're right. China, because of the way the country is governed, has been able to do things that would be very difficult to do in almost any other country in the world. I can imagine the rebellion you would have if you tried to shut down London and quarantine millions of people in the same way that's happened in Wuhan.
For low-income countries, though, it could be really difficult, couldn't it?
Exactly. The real issue there might be that you might not even spot that it's happening for some time if you don't have the surveillance in the first place. And that would be one of the real dangers, say, if this was exported to, say, Africa or South America, where you have weaker healthcare systems, but there are strong connections with China, then, yes, you have the danger that the outbreak could happen and not really be noticed for some time and be too late to do a huge amount about it. And certainly the idea that you could build huge hospitals. I mean, we saw how much of a struggle it was to contain Ebola in places like Democratic Republic of Congo, where they're still struggling with it, or in West Africa, if we go back to the previous Ebola outbreak. So you kind of get a sense of how fragile some healthcare systems are in the world, and you really don't want to put coronavirus on top of those.
We need a name for it, really, don't we? Because there is its scientific name, which is the snappily titled 2019 nCoV. But we need a short name for it, really, don't we? Like SARS or MERS.
Well, if you were following the early stages on Twitter, you would have seen hashtag WuFlu, short for like Wuhan flu. I mean, that's wrong on so many levels. This really isn't a flu. But nobody's really come forward with a better idea yet. There have been suggestions that maybe in the same way that storms and hurricanes and typhoons are given a name that cycles through the alphabet, maybe you could do that with viruses and new emerging diseases. But I don't think anyone's ready to call this Claudia coronavirus yet.
I mean, I don't mind. We could call it that, but I don't know. Well, thank you, James. Now, of course, this coronavirus is just one of many infectious diseases. And every year there are more than 160,000 deaths from typhoid, which spreads via contaminated water. It's caused by a bacterium which gives you a fever, severe diarrhea and a headache. And if it's not treated with antibiotics, it kills one in five of those infected. But multi-drug resistant typhoid has emerged, which cannot be treated with first line antibiotics. So scientists are calling for more preventative measures to stop infections in the first place. A new exhibition in Oxford about the disease will later tour Bangladesh, Malawi and Nepal, and it's called Alice in Typhoid Land, named after Alice Liddell, who inspired the literary character Alice in Wonderland. Now, her father was a champion of improving sanitation in Victorian England, and her mother survived typhoid. Our reporter Louisa Field went to Oxford to meet two of the people behind the exhibition, social scientist Samantha van der Skloot and medical historian Claes Kischeller.
We designed a world around typhoid in Victorian Oxford, and the reason we chose Alice Liddell, aka Alice in Wonderland, as our main theme is that while we were doing research on the history of typhoid, we found the name of Alice in the family cropping up again and again.
What we wanted to do through this exhibition, instead of going down the rabbit hole, is actually go down the sewer hole.
Sounds a bit smelly.
Yeah,
and the sewers.
And smelly would have been dangerous at that time,
okay,
because you had the theory of miasma where smelly air was actually causing ill health.
I don't think I've ever met someone so excited about sewage systems as you two.
We didn't think we were either, but we've managed to get very excited about it through the course of this exhibition.
The bug that causes typhoid, Salmonella typhi, was first identified in the late 19th century. 20 years later, a German scientist called Robert Koch discovered that not only was it a killer, spread by poor sanitation and open sewers, but you could unknowingly be a carrier of the disease, helping it to spread without getting ill yourself. One such carrier was Mary Mallon, a respected cook in New York City.
What seems to happen in every family that Mary cooks for is that people start becoming ill. And the reason for that is that Mary Mallon, aka Typhoid Mary, is the most famous so-called healthy carrier that we know of.
Mary's America is the early 20th century, a time of progress. Cities get fitted with electricity, telephones, movie theatres, steel, railroads, machines. Science is going full steam ahead. But we are still far away from scientists truly unravelling the secret lives of bacteria. Even further away is the discovery of antibiotics. It took a detective, George Soper, to track down Mary. He was hired by a concerned and disease-struck household, knew about Robert Koch's work, and quickly traced the spread of typhoid back to Mary. He knocks on her door and demands a sample of her fluids. Among other things, her poo. Mary takes great offence and refuses. Can't say I blame her.
Bacteriology at this point in time is a new discipline. The knowledge of bacteria is completely new. Mary does not believe it.
Someone's telling her that these little weird tiny animals are living inside her body and she's making people ill. That would be a hard one to swallow, especially if they're taking your profession away.
Absolutely, and also because it's casting a bad light on your hygiene habits as a cook and as a proud cook. So there is this inherent tension in the story of Mary Mallon, where on the one hand said, yes, she is a healthy carrier, she is spreading typhoid, people that she was cooking for die. On the other hand, she is an Irish immigrant in the US in the early 1900s facing a growing anti-immigration climate.
Mary does eventually get tested. The result is positive, and she is quarantined against her will on North Brother Island outside New York City. 3 years later, though, she's released, provided that she doesn't work as a cook again. But she starts to work under a new name, Mary Brown. And once again, typhoid strikes her employers.
And this time, because she is recalcitrant, at least those are the words of the male prosecutors who then speak against her.
Interesting word you put in there, male.
Absolutely. It is a reason that her case is sensationalist. She is not the only typhoid carrier around during this period. Other typhoid carriers are also being found, but Mary is sensationalized by the press. Again, she's female, she's Irish, she's supposedly ignorant, and there are these graphics of the time of really spreading typhoid in an almost nefarious way to her employers.
In 1939, Mary dies, never having accepted that she was a typhoid carrier. Things have moved on a lot since then. It is now tackled with antibiotics and vaccines. But a new threat looms: antibiotic-resistant typhoid, known as XDR.
There are still parts of the world that don't have sanitation systems and clean water. And we also have the rise of antibiotic-resistant typhoid, so strains that are resistant to most of the commonly used antibiotics.
It was always a disease that was with us. It's just that in wealthy countries we got rid of it and then we tended to forget about it. Now, XDR is a wake-up call for the global community that shows that we ignore diseases in poorer countries at our own peril.
Across the road from the Western Library in Oxford is the second half of Clayt's and Samantha's exhibition.
And we're standing in front of our displays on the history of vaccination and typhoid control, seen from not the perspective of sanitation, but from the bacterium itself.
A new typhoid vaccine has been fast-tracked here in Oxford, which for the first time can be given to children under two, a very vulnerable group. It's now providing longer-lasting immunity than other typhoid vaccines for those in India, Nepal, Cambodia and Nigeria who've just been given it.
The new typhoid conjugate vaccine was tested in Oxford Vaccine Group and 100 participants actually drank live typhoid bacteria to test whether the vaccine worked very well.
Vaccines can take quite a long time to develop, but this one, there was sort of an urgency and it was actually rolled out pretty fast from start to finish.
Yeah, so this vaccine got approval from the WHO, got pre-approval quite quickly because of the outbreaks that were going on. This is a way of actually quickening the process of developing a vaccine because you need to test for safety and efficacy, so the effectiveness of the vaccine. And doing this in a smaller group of people rather than whole populations to begin with is a way of speeding up that process.
So the new vaccine, is it going to protect against that antibiotic-resistant type of typhoid as well?
Yeah, so it's shown to be very effective. So this is our best hope at the moment as a preventative method, along with sanitation, water and hygiene methods.
Louisa Field reporting. You're listening to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond, and my guest today is BBC Health and Science correspondent James Gallagher. Now, James, there is some good news today for smokers, and this is just published in the journal Nature. What is this good news?
Yeah, it's good news, but only if you quit. And I think this is a really fascinating, really interesting story that really tips on its head everything we thought we knew about the damage smoking does. So we know that all those toxic chemicals in tobacco smoke, when they get inside your lungs, they corrupt those healthy cells, they slowly morph them into cancerous cells. And, you know, for decades, we've thought that when you smoke and when you stop smoking, well, that damage is permanent. That damage is done. You can't do anything about it. Stopping smoking stops any new damage, but you're stuck with the damage you've caused. This study shows that's not true. So what they've done is they've looked at patients' cells inside their lungs from people before they get cancer and analysed what's going on. So smokers, nearly every single cell in their lungs is corrupted by tobacco. And they've got tens of thousands of mutations that drive them towards becoming cancerous. But there are a few, a tiny few, which the scientists describe as being like hidden in a nuclear bunker, that are protected from the damage from smoking.
So why is that important, that there are these cells that have escaped?
Well, when you stop smoking, they're like the little seeds that after a massive fire grow up again. So they reseed the lungs, they grow and they regenerate the lungs so that after a short period of time, those cells come to take over the lungs. So 40% of the cells in the lungs come from these ones that survived, you know, the genetic devastation of smoking to repopulate the lungs. And they look almost identical to the cells from people who had never smoked. And this is finally explaining why we know that your risk of lung cancer falls when you quit smoking.
But of course, that doesn't mean that all damage from smoking is reversible, is it?
Completely. That other 60% of your cells still have that 10,000 or so mutations.
Thanks, James. Now, let me ask you something. Do you ever suffer from imposter syndrome?
Quite a lot, actually.
Well, you're not alone. When she picked up her award for Best Actress for The Crown at the Golden Globes a few weeks ago, Olivia Colman said in her acceptance speech that she couldn't believe this award was really for her.
Oh, I said I had money on this not happening. For the last year, I feel like I've been living someone else's life, and now I feel like I've definitely won someone else's award.
And you don't have to be a film star or even massively successful to identify with that sentiment. Imposter syndrome is the idea that we feel we shouldn't really be allowed to do what we're doing, and that eventually everyone else will realise that and we'll be busted. A new research shows that it's more widespread than we thought. I spoke to two very successful people who surely can't suffer from imposter syndrome. Professor Richard Gardner from the University of Nevada, who's done this new research, and Dr. Steve Nimmo, editor of the journal Occupational Medicine in the UK.
Imposter syndrome is something that largely affects successful people, causing them to doubt their abilities and their accomplishments, and to have a fear of being exposed as a fraud. And I think it's the fear of being exposed as a fraud which is the crux of it. I get it all the time. In my specialty, I'm reasonably well known and I'm reasonably successful, and I still wonder how on earth I got here and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I'm wondering what I'm doing here right now, to be honest. And I'm sure that...
join the club. I think we all think that.
Somebody's going to catch me out sooner or later. And I was at the largest occupational health conference in the US back in May. And the person that was supposed to be delivering the UK keynote speech had to drop out, and I was asked to deliver it. And I found myself on the stage thinking, oh, my goodness, what am I doing here?
Yeah, because in one way, what you should be thinking is, well, they asked you. They could have chosen from all these other people, and they asked you, so they clearly think you're the best person for the job.
I think so, but it's also they don't realise I'm a fraud. I'm worried I'm going to say something that will make it clear that I don't belong here.
And so your new study, Richard, you looked at business students, trainees. Mm-hmm. How many people did you find had imposter syndrome? Is it the fact that everyone's actually thinking this about everyone else, or is it just some people?
Well, it's not everyone. But in terms of percentage, at least the majority of the people felt this way at some point within their schooling, within their career. So we did two studies with this. One was a qualitative study. So we were doing interviews with people. And these were students that were thinking back on their first year of this. What it is this accounting program. So these are students who are accounting students, which is a very career-oriented program. They're all very accomplished, high-achieving students. So they've demonstrated capability. But now once they get into that program, their comparison reference are all these other very high-achieving accounting students. And so we did find that because the bar is so much higher, they are starting to feel more inadequate. But then we also did another study where we actually surveyed them through their first semester of this program. So we were able to track, you know, if they were changing in terms of their feelings of imposterism, what was affecting those feelings of imposter syndrome.
And what sort of things were affecting it?
What was interesting was we found that where they were seeking social support tended to affect it. And there's been previous research about social support and imposter syndrome, and perhaps unsurprising is the more social support you receive, the less you'll feel like an imposter. However, what we found was it depended on the source of that social support. If students were reaching out to other students in their classes for help with homework, for support in the program, they actually felt more like an imposter because they're making themselves very vulnerable. So if you imagine if I was a student and I go ask my classmate and I say, I'm having a hard time with this homework. Can you help me with this? And I find that person knows all the answers. I feel like, oh, good grief. You know, I may not belong here. Everybody knows what's going on except for me. But we found that if they sought for social support from people outside of the program, outside of their direct comparisons, that tended to decrease their feelings of imposter syndrome.
Because I suppose maybe if you reach outside of it, then they're kind of impressed by this thing. They're impressed that you can do this thing at all, unlike the people who might be your peers.
You know, people outside of the program can give broader perspective of, you know, that's just one facet of your life. You're doing just fine, really, when you look at the grand scheme of things.
Steve, would you say it's the case that many people who experience imposter syndrome would want to try and do their best to hide it, if you like?
I think so. And I think the great risk with imposter syndrome is it limits your courage to pursue new opportunities.
What strategies are there that people can adopt to try to avoid this feeling or cope with this feeling? Richard, what would you say?
So we did find that some people tried to cognitively escape from the source of feeling like an imposter through very effective means. So some people, it was intramural sports, perhaps, or other social activities. Another thing, too, is adjusting your comparison reference. You know, one particular participant, she described how she felt like an imposter through the program. But then when she went away and did her internship, and now she was exposed to other interns that were from other schools that had other experiences, and then she felt, oh, actually, I'm doing quite well. You know, I know more than I thought I knew.
And Steve, what else would you say people could do?
I think it's important to acknowledge the thoughts of phoniness and to put them in perspective. and to think, does this help me or hinder me? Learning to value constructive criticism is also important, because I think people with imposter syndrome can take criticism quite badly. But also it's important not to let doubt control your actions. It's fine to have the occasional imposter moment, but don't let imposter syndrome limit your life.
Steve Nimmo and Richard Gardner. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, James Gallagher. We'll release you back to the newsroom to write some more about the coronavirus. But let me ask you something. Have you taken the touch test yet? We launched it on Health Check last week, this online questionnaire. And it's part of a major new piece of research that psychologists at Goldsmiths University of London have created in collaboration with the Wellcome Collection. Have you filled it in?
I can't make eye contact with you, Claudia, while I admit that I haven't done it yet.
Don't worry, because you've still got time. It's okay. But it covers everything from what you think about touch in medical care to whether you like to hug someone when you say hello. And there's questions about things like, do you like having a massage from like a massage therapist if it's a stranger? Do you like that?
If it's the right person. You don't want an unsolicited massage though, do you?
No, I don't think you do. And we do ask people all about what touch is appropriate at work and in different places. And we want people from all over the world to take part at touchtest.org, and you get a snapshot of some of the results straight away, and then the rest will be analysed for many months to come, and then we'll hear about those later. So what are you going to go and do after this, James?
I've got more coronavirus to do.
And later on.
And then later on I've got more coronavirus to do. And after that, I'll do the touch test.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, James. And thanks to the producer, Paula McGrath. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Claudia Hammond. I will be back at the same time next week when we'll hear from the Inuit children flying 6 hours for healthcare in a clinic specially designed to stop them feeling homesick. Isn't that nice? Bye for now. And if you'd like something else to listen to now, here's news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
The Compass is the podcast from the BBC World Service that really gets under the skin of a story.
I can tell you what I believe is not the truth, and you know it's not the truth, and I'll get away with it. So I will tell a lie.
With series that take an in-depth look at how the world today really works.
Sometimes I think that we are moving into the right direction and change is happening. And then I realize that 9 to 10 women get killed every day in this country. So I don't feel we're moving forward at all.
And why things are the way they are.
I have been socialized to be a soldier, to be someone aggressive, and even to dominate, especially women or other people. So I have this kind of fear that, what if I one day become a violent person?
The Compass Podcast from the BBC World Service.
She shamed the politicians into taking an interest in it.
Search for The Compass wherever you get your podcasts.